Roberta Blevins, and this is Life After MLM, a podcast where we worked in the stigma of failure in an industry systemically designed for you to fail. Join us as we dive into the real-life stories of survivors, experts, and advocates, as we debunk the common myths and fallacies of cults, frauds, scams, and multi-level marketing. Hey, Hunbots and Hunbros, we have another heavy episode for Child Abuse Awareness Month. Today's episode is about the troubled teen industry. We have covered this before a couple times, but not in depth like today. Lots of trigger warnings. We talk about child abuse, kidnapping, and CSA. And so I just want everybody to be very aware of those topics because I know how triggering they can be. And to just, if this is not the episode for you, to go ahead and skip it. If you are a survivor of the troubled teen industry and you are ready to hear this, it might be very beneficial. So if you are in the headspace to receive this message, there are a lot of great resources at the end as well if you just want to skip to the end. But we are talking with Meg Applegate. She is the CEO of Unsilenced, which is an incredible foundation that is helping not only the survivors of this industry, but they're also doing work to help end this industry as well. I also want to thank Christy Freeman and Morgan for joining our Patreon. It is wonderful to have you. And last but not least, I want to give you an MLM update. So the MLM that I started talking about back in July, Transact Card, that then sort of took off in November, a couple other advocates started talking about it. Julie Anderson and I have actually created some content on Transact Card. They turned into Finmore, and then a bunch of people left ship, and they created a new MLM called Nilo Life. It's very complicated, but I have like a whole playlist on TikTok about this entire thing if you're really, really interested. Anyway, this weekend on Friday, they just sent out a letter saying, we're no longer. So Transact Card and Finmore are done. They closed their doors. It's always hard as an advocate when an MLM shuts down because you're happy as an activist that the MLM shut down and the work that you do is actually reaching the right people and we're getting these results. But as an advocate who also speaks to victims, I can't help but feel really bad for all the people that got sucked into this, that lost money, that were lied to, that believed all the promises. It's a bummer. And my heart goes out to them. This is 100% why I make the content that I do. This is why I warn people when I see the red flags, because I've been through the ringer and I've heard all the stories of all the people that have also been through the ringer. And so if you're listening and you found this podcast because of my coverage of Transact Card and you were involved in any way, if you ever need to talk, I am here. My door is open. You can email me, therealrobertablevins@gmail.com, and we can have a conversation. There's no expectation. If you just need somebody to talk to and make you feel less crazy, I'm here. I understand. And there's a whole community that is waiting for you once you realize that MLMs are the problem. Bummer to the victims. Happy that another MLM has shut down. Just, I kind of feel a little vindicated also because like everything I predicted would happen, happened. And I was able to predict it and then report on it. It was a very interesting ride. It's been a very interesting 9 months with this sort of in the back of my head. And hearing the news on Friday, I did make a video that's on TikTok and Instagram that I put out on Friday. If anybody is interested, reading the letter that was put out and sort of adding my hilarious 2 cents. The 2 cents that you have all come to know and love. And you can find that video on my TikTok and both my personal and the podcast's Instagram page as well. Okay, here's your final trigger warning. We're heading into this episode now. Enjoy. Welcome back to another episode of Life After MLM. We've been kind of working towards this episode. It's a big one, lots of trigger warnings, so be prepared. We've talked about the exploitation of children. We've talked about the troubled teen industry in passing and in stories. But today we are going to be digging into that just a little deeper with a lot more information. So I would love to welcome to the show my guest, Meg Applegate, who is the founder and CEO of unsilenced.org. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you for having me.
It is so good to have you here and to start this conversation. I've wanted to talk about the troubled teen industry for a very long time. We have had people come on the show and tell us their MLM experiences and their previous troubled teen industry experiences and the stories that I have seen, the documentaries that we have watched. It is so unbelievably triggering and horrific. We're going to dive into this because this has been, I think, something in our culture and in pop culture for a very long time as a very normalized thing. I remember growing up and literally having fear of being kidnapped if I did anything wrong because I saw it on like Sally, Jesse, Raphael, and Maury. And I was one of those like, whoa, just be good. Just like, oh, there's a cop. Make sure I'm doing 65. Like, just such a rule follower. Thanks, yep. Mom.
Same.
And so watching these things and seeing this happen to children in these boot camps and these stories, and just, it was such a terrifying thing to grow up watching on television. And you obviously had an experience here. I am just really happy to have you here to talk about your experience and to talk about not only the history of the troubled teen industry, but where it is now and where it is heading and what you are doing to make it a better place for all of the kids out there today.
Yeah, no, I'm so happy to be here. Starting this conversation is so important just because we need to raise awareness to a certain level if we want to be able to see that social change that we need to see in order to stop this industry. So I'm happy to be here.
Yes. Before we get into this topic, can you please, just for everybody listening who may not understand what the troubled teen industry is, can you just give us the quick elevator pitch so we're all on the same page?
Yeah, for sure. So the troubled teen industry is a network of powerful and punitive congregate care facilities that claim to reform youth by using behavior modification practices. Kids are oftentimes told that they're going to be, you know, getting help for their educational differences or perceived behavioral problems, when in reality, youth are entering these facilities and they're leaving calling themselves survivors. And these programs go by names that are pretty wide, but things like therapeutic boarding schools, wilderness therapy programs, boot camps, group homes, and religious academies.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Did you have the similar experience of seeing this sort of stuff happening on TV, or were there threats from your parents? Like, set the scene, take us back there.
To be honest, no, I never really knew anything about this industry. And that really continued until I was like 33. So I didn't really know that this was an industry at all until pretty recently. Wow. But growing up, I had no idea. I was adopted at birth. And so I grew up always kind of feeling like I didn't belong. And I had trouble fitting in. And I was also undiagnosed autistic for a majority of my life. And I had ADHD. So I struggled in school. That was way before people really understood what ADHD was. And so they would see it as like oppositional defiance, right? If you're in school and you're under the desk playing with things when it's in the middle of a lesson, they see it as, oh my gosh, that's a troublemaker, versus, oh wow, she can't sit still and she can't help it. That set the stage, if you will, for just not feeling like I fit in. And so when I got into high school, I was like, okay, now's my chance, right? Now is the time I need to just find my group, find my people. And of course, I found my people in kind of the counterculture, you know, group of kids that are skipping school and smoking pot and, you know, not caring about authority. And they were really accepting of me. And it was the first group that I wasn't bullied by. It was the first group that really saw me for what I saw as being me. And so, you know, I started smoking pot, which also alleviated some of the anxiety that I was having. It was pretty constant anxiety in my life. I started skipping class every now and then. I'd probably drink, I don't know, like maybe 5 or 6 times. Like I had not drank a ton, but it's something I started to do. And then I'd also started to have sex and interested in boys and kind of getting preoccupied with boys, which is, I might say, very normal.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, scary, right? Scary for parents. All of a sudden, your daughter goes to high school and she's skipping school. She's smoking pot. And this was back then when they, you know, it wasn't accepted. It was definitely illegal as well. It was scary for my parents. To be honest, they tried everything. You know, they found like magic therapy, play therapy. I was seeing a psychiatrist. I was seeing a psychologist. I was seeing a neuropsychologist. I had scans. No one could figure out exactly, besides ADHD, that didn't fit everything, the ways that I was struggling. Now, looking back, it's because I was autistic. And back then, the stereotype for autism was very much so the higher support needs kind of view of autism, of not being female too. So a female with autism back then is like unheard of. Like it just wasn't diagnosed at the rate that it is today. We're realizing a lot of different things, right? We know it's a spectrum now. So it's not just the high support needs that are getting diagnosed now, right? So that was another thing that was going on, I believe. What my parents did is, you know, they got to the end of the rope. I had tried 5 different schools to try to accommodate my needs. And I was either, well, I was really bullied in every single one of them until the one I got expelled in. And what they ended up doing is hiring something called an educational consultant. And I can get into that later. But basically, they are hired, they're very expensive, and they claim to be kind of experts in alternative placements for youth.
Just even the phrase alternative placements for youth is like...
Oh, I know. It's so weird.
And a quick question, were your parents religious? Were you raised in the church?
Well, yes. I mean, I was raised going to Sunday school, but then like when I got to the age that I didn't want to go, they didn't make me. I definitely grew up Protestant, basically just the principles of Christianity, but we did go to a Protestant church, but it wasn't pushed on me.
So nothing fundy or culty, just like a ribbon of influence.
Yeah. I mean, my parents, you know, definitely believed in the Christian beliefs and it just basically, you know, helped dictate their behavior. They act with kindness and love, but they never talked about it in weird ways that made me feel uncomfortable or anything like that. But an educational consultant basically exists to, I mean, I'm going to be honest, it's a pipeline into the troubled teen industry. And it almost always is going to end up in the industry versus like other types of placements that are within the community. They hired this woman. She recommended, you know, the industry. And meanwhile, I'm struggling in school and my grades are suffering. And then one day ended up skipping school with one of my best friends. And we had this guy that we found on the side of the road next to a 7-Eleven by a spear. He ended up like kind of following us around and stuff like that. And we only got a 6-pack. So it didn't make sense that within an hour, we were both completely blacked out and we were sexually assaulted in the park. While I have no proof, I definitely believe that we were drugged. The school found out about how we drank during school hours, and we had lied about how we got off of campus because we were so scared we were going to get in trouble for drinking and leaving campus. So we told the truth about the sexual assault, but we added in the safety component of him making us leave campus because he did have a knife and he showed us a knife. So we said that he saw us on campus, had the knife and made us leave and made us drink because we were so scared, right? You know, the FBI got involved, the police got involved. It was like this big thing. And when they found out that we lied about how getting off campus, the FBI didn't believe me and they didn't believe us. And I just found this out like 5 months ago that they told my parents that I was not assaulted because I was officially labeled a liar. And that happens a lot with victims, right? It's so normal for victims to recant and to backtrack and be scared of what they'll say or minimize, right? You know, we've learned a lot about what victims can say and the normal course of how your story can look when you're a true victim. And it's not lying. It's not, you know, it doesn't mean that they're making it up. It's very normal. but they didn't know that back then. So I was expelled, right? Because I drank off campus during school hours. I never consumed alcohol on campus. However, California had a zero tolerance policy, which meant that any consumption of a substance that's not approved during the hours school is in session, you will be expelled. Absolutely horrible for children. I mean, I can't, that's just horrible. I ended up being expelled, and about maybe 3 weeks later, I was woken up in the middle of the night by two strangers that told me, "You're coming with us." And I remember thinking I was being kidnapped. And well, I was being kidnapped, but I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I need to find my parents. Like, this is just in the movies. I'm going to be hurt. You know, I'm going to be hurt. And I remember being like, no, I'm not. And they said, well, we can do this the easy way or the hard way. And then they explained that the hard way meant that there were handcuffs involved. And I remember just being so scared and like looking around. I've never felt like such a kid. You know what I mean? Like, when you're 15, you feel like you know everything. And in that moment, I felt like a baby. I felt like a child, because I was, all of that ego that every 15-year-old has just slipped away. And I remember thinking, where's my mom and dad? You know, just, I'm so scared. And I remember looking at the door and seeing them watch it. And my mom was crying and she was saying, we're not abandoning you. We're not abandoning you, you know. And they made me get up and I asked if I could, you know, I said I had to go to the bathroom, and they said, well, we have to watch you. And I said, can I at least change? And they said, well, we have to watch you do that too. I did all that. And I said, well, can I at least pack a bag? And they said, your parents already did. Oh. And that's when I flipped. That is when I knew that this was all prearranged. And here is this adopted kid too. Like, that was the worst part of it, is I always felt like I didn't fit in. And so here my parents, who I loved so much, were willingly having me picked up and kidnapped. And that's when I freaked out at them. And I told them that I'm never fucking talking to them again. And I hate you. And I'll never forgive you for this. And they put me in the back of an SUV. They drove me to LAX, and I wasn't allowed to know where I was going. So they had to like turn me around every time there was, you know, a sign of where we were going to. So I was facing away from the gate. I couldn't know where we were going until we were on the plane, when the pilot said, we're on our way to Boise, Idaho. And I was like, what the fuck? Then they handed me an envelope with a letter from my parents telling me why they had done this. And that's when I really just disassociated completely. And I don't remember the plane ride. I don't remember getting into the cab or the car when we got there. But I do remember walking into the doors of Intermountain Hospital in Boise. It's a lockdown facility. So there's magnetic locked doors, right? And I remember walking through them and hearing the doors just, you know, that magnetic lock sound right behind me. And I just felt my entire childhood just slip away. And I knew nothing would ever be the same. And I had no idea what to expect. Little did I know at that point, though, that my parents were freaking out, because they had no idea that the kidnapping would look like this. They were not told anything about what to expect. They basically said that they answered the door. They didn't even identify themselves or something. They're like, where is she? And they just went down to my room. They were told all of this stuff and manipulated into thinking if they didn't do this, I would run away and die. Like, so they use fear mongering. And so my parents, you know, obviously regret every second of that, but they were manipulated into thinking this is what they needed to do.
I'm sitting here listening to you tell the story, and I'm trying to put myself in both your shoes, that's terrifying, and your parents' shoes, being a parent myself, and thinking like what they had to go through to even think that was an option. And then also being, like you just said, being lied to. Like, they think, we've hired this consultant, which is, I don't know, you could tell us, like, paid. Are they paid by the troubled teen industry?
Oh, yeah.
So you're right.
No, I mean, yeah, you can kind of, we've seen tons of kickbacks. Right.
Right. A recruiter comes to the door. You ask for help and a recruiter shows up and they go, well, there's a couple things you could do, but the best thing you could do is this. And they paint it as, we're going to save your kid. It's tough love. It's what they need. It's the hard, tough love that you don't want to give them as the parent. And we have that one degree of separation, so we can do that. And we're going to fix it, right? Which is all a lie. It's all just to get you there. Your parents sign on the dotted line and go, okay, this is here. You don't know any of this is happening. You're kidnapped in the middle of the night. You say, can I grab a bag? And they're like, oh, your parents have already packed. And you're like, oh, they're in on this too. Like, you're finding this out. Your heart is literally breaking
as all this is happening, your parents are watching this and they're like, well, this is not what we signed up for. Their heart is breaking. They're probably feeling immediate regret. This is not what we wanted to do. Just ripping you guys apart, throwing you into a plane. And your parents are just like, oh my God, we wrote you a letter. I hope you don't hate us. Like, this is vile.
I know.
This sort of stuff shouldn't have happened.
The crazy thing is that they thought that was still the best thing they could have done until like 3 years ago when I told them how traumatizing it was. They had no idea.
Of course they didn't.
Yeah.
Of course they didn't, because everybody trusted a commodified abuser. Like, yep. Let's call them what they are.
Yep. And so whenever you go to any of these, you know, a lot of people have first placements that are wilderness programs, which are shorter term, right? But also there's residential treatment centers, which is what I went to. Both of those are oftentimes feeders. If they're not long-term, they're feeders into the long-term placements. So I've never heard someone that has been to wilderness programs where they didn't suggest longer placement. They are 100% a pipeline into the longer placements. And that's kind of what happened to me. I went to Intermountain Hospital, which was a 6-month placement. And then I ended up having, thank God, you know, I didn't get transported again, but I spent like a week with my parents in a family vacation. And then I was off to my therapeutic boarding school and I spent the next 3 years there. At Intermountain Hospital, it was just such a different environment than the therapeutic boarding school. It's like a hospital, but it's like there's magnetic locked doors. There's a quiet room, which is a locked room that's padded with a bed in the middle with straps in case they have to like restrain kids. I saw daily restraints on children where they would pull their pants down and shoot them up with Halidol or whatever it is to restrain them, and hearing kids screaming. And it was very chaotic. Looking back, like more overt abuse, if that makes sense. Like I was on something called desk space. The whole point of desk space was actually to strip away my control. And they even told me that you're not in control all the time and you need to learn that. So to teach me that, they had a bag of yeses and nos written on a piece of paper. And there were 9 no's and 1 yes. And I had to sit at a desk all day long writing assignments on thinking errors that I am having in my everyday life, like all 36 thinking errors. And I had to write like 2 pages for each, right? Anytime there's like going to the group therapy or going to the cafeteria or PE or any of the therapy sessions, I'd have to pick out of the bag. And if I got a yes, I got to go. But if I got a no, I had to sit and write. And that was all day long. So considering there was only 1 yes in that bag, it didn't happen very often. And they were trying to teach me that I have no control over my life. Don't try. It really set the stage for what I considered in the next program to be a lot of brainwashing that happened, right? Because they had already taught me that I have no control. I have to follow authority. I can't speak up for myself because it doesn't matter. My voice doesn't matter. So they had already kind of set the stage for what happened at my next program called Chrysalis. And in my opinion, Chrysalis was much more of a standard cult, as many of the therapeutic boarding schools are and RTCs. I mean, across the board, if you look at what makes a cult, it is 100% fitting into that category, especially when you consider how long you're usually there. And Chrysalis is much different than that place.
Wow. So Chrysalis was the boarding school.
Yes. A therapeutic boarding school is what we say. So that there is a difference. Yes, there is a difference. Therapeutic boarding schools, we would consider to be a part of the troubled teen industry, where boarding schools, just straight boarding schools, we would not. And it's because of the element of behavior modification, right? And therapy and stuff like that. So if a boarding school is just a dorm and you go to school and class and then you go home and you're able to go to the dorms and do what you want, you can have cell phones, you can contact your parents. There's no elements of like coercion and control, then we wouldn't consider those to be part of the troubled teen industry.
Do you ever wonder how much of your personal data is out there on the internet just for anyone to find? I promise it's more than you think. Your name, contact info, social security number, home address, even information about your family members. It's all being compiled by data brokers and openly sold online. This can lead to a lot of problems, including identity theft, phishing attempts, harassment, and unwanted spam calls.
But now you can protect your privacy with Delete Me. Signing up for the service is super easy. Just provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts take it from there. They send you regular, personalized privacy reports showing what info they found, where they found it, and what they removed. I got my report, and I was floored with the results. Of the 105 data brokers they checked, 83 of them had my data. Delete Me then removed 173 listings of my personal data off the internet. And they make sure that it stays off too. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me at a special discount just for our listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/MLM and use promo code MLM at checkout. The only way to get the 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/MLM and enter code MLM at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/MLM, code MLM.
You're using, you know, therapeutic boarding school, and I have no concept. What does a therapeutic boarding school look like?
So it can look really different depending on which ones you go. Mine was very small at the time that I got there. So there were only 10 girls in my therapeutic boarding school, and we all lived in a log cabin in the middle of the woods and in the middle of nowhere. And I know it sounds so culty when you say it, so it just always makes me laugh. Oh my God. And like the people that lived with us were a married couple, and they were both therapists, and they were our therapists. We called each other Chrysalis sisters and referred to everyone as a Chrysalis family. And for the first 6 months I was there, I actually lived in the room next to my therapists and shared a bathroom with my therapists. It's very much so controlled environment. Every aspect of your day is scheduled. You get up, we have to get up by 6. We have to work out for an hour. They make you work out. And if you go too slow, they will tell you that you're slacking and you're not working hard enough. And you can never not do it because of an ailment or feeling sick or anything like that. You must work out every day. Then after that, you have to do chores. And the chores are done before breakfast. If you eat before your chores, you will be punished. All the girls are responsible for the upkeep of the entire property. And we're talking many acres of property here. That we had a gigantic horse pasture. We had a house with a huge lawn. I can't even guess at how big of a property this was because I have no data to be able to tell me. We were responsible for mowing the lawn, washing all of the vehicles of the staff of Kenny and Mary's, their own vehicles, the owners, and then even staff sometimes. We cooked all the meals. We did all of the dishes. We did all of the deep cleaning. We did all of the gardening. We did all of the feeding of the animals, picked up manure of the horses and all this stuff. So it was very heavy into the physical labor component of control, really. And physical labor was oftentimes used as a consequence as well. So for instance, they were big on picking up after yourself. So let's say you left a textbook out in the common area overnight, it would go to jail. And so they would put it into jail. And in order to get that out of jail, you had to do a 30-minute consequence. And that could be washing logs or filling a wheelbarrow up with rocks and moving it from one place to another in the horse pasture for no reason. They would give you physical labor to make you not make mistakes. There was that aspect of it. And then there was the aspect of the therapy. And I'm giving a heavy air quote on therapy because Chrysalis's biggest thing that I remember is their group therapy.
This reminds me of Scientology, yeah. Of the kids' camp. This is Scientology. This is moving railroad ties and digging ditches that you can lay down in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Moving rocks from one side of a corral to another, washing logs.
I know.
Like, what?
So funny. I know. And I can only laugh about it. But like the reason why it didn't work. But the reason why you end up like acquiescing to everything is because it's literally brainwashing, in my opinion. What made it work, though, to get to that brainwashing point was their group therapy, which they called Circle. I'm going to back up and zoom out for just a second, because it's important to know the etiology of circle or group therapy when you look at really across the board, any kind of RTC, therapeutic boarding school, or wilderness programs, that any kind of group environment is almost always going to stem from one of the techniques that they used in Synanon, which it was a cult back in 1958. They used something called the game. And the game was basically a group therapy, air quotes, of them sitting in a circle and publicly berating and humiliating the other members until they would acquiesce to, you know, the Synanon principles, right? And so that is what they're using, because the people, the true believers in Synanon, once it disbanded, went on to form their own abusive spin-off programs focused on youth. And that is the descendants of the modern day group homes, therapeutic boarding schools, and RTCs. You see a lot of that with different names, right? There's different names. That was what Circle was. It was a way for all of the Chrysalis girls to sit in a circle and confront each other and hold each other accountable, is what they would say. I can tell you that it would, you know, sometimes it went on for 6 hours and you would just sit there hearing shit about yourself constantly. And the way that it breaks you down into believing that you are absolutely nothing is wild, and how fast it works too, because you get so sick of hearing everything wrong with you that you just like shut down. And I remember that feeling of shutdown where I was just like, I don't care anymore. And it reached, once I was able to name it, once I got into school for psychology, as learned helplessness. I remember distinctly feeling that I give up, do what you want feeling, where I just like turned a leaf and I was like, yep, they've got me. Because I just wanted it to stop. And when you want to stop being abused, it's amazing what you will do. And then that becomes just doing, is starts off with just doing the things I want, but then that slowly becomes who you are. And that becomes your principles, your morals, your values. And then all of a sudden you're indoctrinated. You believe what they're saying.
I could just like imagine sitting in a circle of your peers, your family, your sisters, and just participating in a group gaslighting session about yourself. Yeah, and just sitting there and just letting everybody tell you how stupid and dumb and airing all their grievances. How often did these happen?
I believe anywhere 3 or 4 times a week.
3 or 4 times a week?
Yeah. So up to like 16 hours a week of this probably. Yeah.
How do you have so many grievances with people like after one day of telling them all of the things that you don't like about them?
You have no idea. Like if you confront people in circle, you're going to be perceived by Kenny and Mary as working the program. So you look for things all week. And these are your friends. These are your Chrysalis sisters. Like you love these girls. I love everyone that I went to Chrysalis with. But that doesn't mean you're not trying to save yourself. And saving yourself is getting out. So getting out means that you have to virtually kind of throw everyone that you love under the bus. You have to watch all week. Did they sneak a granola bar? Ooh, I'm going to put that in my hip pocket and I'm going to bring that up in circle this week. Or did I see them talking to a boy? Oh my gosh, I'm going to bring that up in circle this week. Because then Kenny and Mary are going to say that I'm doing well. You become someone you're not because you want to survive. And, you know, it really goes back to Janja Lalić with bounded choice, right? These are the things that we do when our morality is the leader's immorality, right? So you will do anything for the good of the group. You will do anything that Kenny, which I saw as the leader, wants, right? So it's crazy what you will do when you think that not doing it is going to put you in harm's way. And so basically we would look all week and watch people. And let's say someone got up late and didn't do their chores before breakfast, you'd bring that up. Someone stole a granola bar. Someone had a glass of milk and now they're going to be on a milk ban because they didn't, you know, you're not allowed to have milk. So, you know, you would always search for them. It's like a constant state of feeling like you're being judged and criticized. So you're scared of doing anything, you know? So it's like Kenny and Mary are watching all the girls and they're, you know, we're the patients, if you will, but we're also mini staff. Right? We're responsible for keeping everyone in the group accountable. So it's a way to really create this environment of just being so scared of making any decision that's not approved, because you're gonna get confronted on it.
I get it. It's a cult thing. You know, I hear it. And as you're saying that, I'm thinking back to like, I had a conversation 2 seasons ago with Spencer Schneider about the cult, the school in New York City. And he talked about the same thing. It's like, you're spying on each other because you have to have ammo in your pocket when they come after you.
Exactly.
You have to be like, well, I stole a granola bar, but you were kissing a boy, and that's worse. It's like this.
Exactly.
You have to have enough ammo in your pocket to keep yourself safe. And then that goes back to sort of the whole MLM aspect of, to not become the one that loses, you have to become the perpetrator. So you're the victim, but also the perpetrator at the same time. So you're all there in this therapy, but you're having to attack them to keep yourself safe.
Exactly. And it's like, and the recruitment, if you will, and the coaching, if you will, is so embedded into the program as well. So like, you know, what makes it so enticing to do well is they'll usually have a point-based system or a level-based system. And if you're doing well, then you move on to the levels and you're level one, level two, level three, and then you graduate. So you really want to get on the levels because the levels equal more privileges and more time alone, more autonomy. So you're desperately wanting to go up in levels because you just want to be left alone and you want more privileges, right? So that's a great incentivization in these programs. But one of the ways they do it, let's say a level two, that's going to start with the where they become little mini brainwashers, right? So once you're on level two, it's a kind of a mini brainwasher. And then level three, it's a big brainwasher. You don't get to level three very easily. It took me 2.5 years. It took me 10 months to get to level two. So it's a lot of work to get to that place. And they don't put you in that place unless they can know that you're going to uphold their values, not in their line of sight. What they do, for instance, with me is once I became brainwashed, like I'm autistic. So like once I was brainwashed, like I'm so rigid on the rules, right? And I'm like, you broke the rule. You broke the rule. I'm constantly holding people accountable. So what they did to me is, hey, you're at a level now where we need you to help so-and-so with their Chrysalis program. And we're going to move you to the other house to be a leader. They use these words, right? But really, they wanted me to do their deeds over there because they knew I wasn't going to go against their wishes, right? They put these girls in circumstances where they have to kind of get them on the program, which is the brainwashing, in my opinion. Like that's what we were helping them do, break them down from a peer point of view versus a staff point of view, which they'd be more resistant to.
And when a leader asks you to do that, is that like an honor? Like, oh, I'm working the system. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. They're asking me to help.
Yes.
It's a good thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I was honored. Yeah. And they expanded their program while I was there. So it went from a house of 10 girls. Then they had another house across the street that they purchased. So then more girls went there. So by the time I left, we had like 32 girls. And when they started the other house, they told me, whenever I talk about my time, I always say Lizzie. I went by Lizzie in the program. They said, Lizzie, we want to move you over to the other house because they're lacking leadership and we know we can count on you. And I was honored. But then it was sad because like I had just found my home. I had been sent from home and now my home and family as I knew it are sending me away again, right? And now I have to go over there. But it is an honor. It was an honor to feel that.
Yeah, I could feel that would be an honor, the way that they frame it, the way that they make you feel about brainwashing others and recruiting others in. It's a good thing. We like that. You're doing the right thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you're desperate. You're mostly desperate for Kenny's attention. There was a constant fight for Kenny's attention. It was extremely toxic. And, you know, in my opinion, Kenny, it displayed narcissistic tendencies, right? And because of that, he had kind of favorites. He had favorite girls. And if you weren't his favorite, you were constantly trying to get his attention. And it was very gross. And the boundaries were very blurred too. You know, here's our therapist, but he would wrestle us and we would have like wrestling competitions with him. And he'd put his arm around us. Like he'd grab our knee. He would grab the back of our neck and like squeeze. And like, that was how he said that he was like happy with you. He would like squeeze the back of your neck and grab your leg in the, and squeeze like where it's really tender, you know, and you're just like ticklish, yeah. You know, that point. And he'd have us sit on his lap sometimes. And like, that was an honor. And it's looking back, it's just, I know.
It's like so gross. I just got like full body chills. Like,
it gives me like the eebie-jeebies. But like, I never thought of that as weird because like, if you're a kid growing up and you sit on your dad's lap, that's not weird. That's not weird at all. And so here's our Chrysalis family. And I think about it like that. So I didn't think it was weird. And then I had kids and I thought, oh, would I want Spencer to sit on her therapist's lap? Wait. I was like, oh, wait, that's so inappropriate.
Right.
And only then did it dawn on me.
It is interesting when you're a child and you don't understand complex like ideas and concepts, and you sort of dumb it down into a way that your brain makes sense. You're like, well, I would sit on my dad's lap and this guy's kind of like my dad. So like, that's okay. And you don't really see anything because you're innocent and you don't have all of these different things like that. Adults are like, no, like there's red flags everywhere. Like little kids don't see that the way that adults see that. And so it's just so interesting to me that you continue, like even now you're still unpacking things as you hit those thresholds of being that adult in the situation and going, wait a second, that was weird. That's weird. Like that shouldn't have been normal. And it's wrestling with teenagers. Like these are all high school aged girls. So 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 years old till you leave.
Yes.
And how old was this man?
He must have been, I don't know, late 40s.
Oh my God. That's like,
And he did it in front of his wife.
Did she tickle you guys or do anything?
No. I mean, she would put her arms around us and give us a hug. I never felt weird when she did it though. And it's because she's a female. Like it's, yeah. I mean, it's just like.
More motherly, yeah.
Now, did she watch it happen? And do I feel like she's completely complicit in letting that happen? Absolutely. And did her presence when it was happening with Kenny make me feel okay? Because I feel like a wife would be like, hey, Kenny, this isn't appropriate. Like, yeah, it made me further think it was okay. But I never felt weird boundary things with her, to be honest, like physical boundaries. Like she never did that. But, you know, you mentioned a really good point of the process of waking up and kind of deprogramming yourself. Because I remember, I don't know, like a month and a half ago, I posted a TikTok of really, you know, because I struggle with CPTSD, as many of us do. And I had a flashback, probably one of my first flashbacks that I visually could only see Kenny's face. And I posted what it looks like to come out of that flashback. And I was really real about like, this is CPTSD. You know, I haven't even talked about this publicly, but the reason why that happened is because I further woke up. And you have these pieces of waking up. And I woke up that point to my relationship with Kenny. And I remember what caused the flashback is having this feeling inside me that I was groomed. And not only was I groomed, but he still didn't want me. If that makes sense, you know, like I was groomed, and he still didn't like me. You know what I mean? And it just caused this crazy flashback and I couldn't get out of it. And luckily I was in a therapy session during it. Thank God. You know, it just shows when it happens over such a long period of time, you know, and people are in cults for much longer than I was for 3.5 years, how hard it is and how long it takes to truly come out of it and be able to process and own everything that's happened. Because I've talked about how I used to sit on Kenny's lap, he used to, you know, wrestle us, but never did it equal waking up to what that meant. And I think it really goes to show just like, it's interesting. The journey you take when you're healing is like, you're never done. You're never done healing. You know, just when you think, oh yeah, I've got it all processed. It's like, here's one more.
I know I find that sometimes when I have conversations outside of MLM, because I've processed so much of that and I understand it. And every time I learn a little bit more, I'm like, oh, that's so fascinating. That's why I did that. And it's not so triggering in like a CPTSD way. It's when I have conversations with people who have had similar experiences to mine that I've just never talked about before. Or like a good example is I've talked about like James Dobson and the fundamentalists and talking about like with shiny, happy people and talked to so many people coming out of fundamental Christian ideology. And like, I looked on my bookshelf and my mom had given me like a bunch of books from when I was a kid. And there were books that she had read as a mom. And one of them was a James Dobson book called The Strong-Willed Child.
Oh my God.
And it was a joke my mother had made my whole life about, oh, well, you were a strong-willed child. And my mom would always make a joke like, you were a strong-willed child and my doctor told me to get this and it sure helped me. And she always made this joke all the time. And so it was always this joke in my head. I was like, yeah, I was a strong-willed child. And I even added that phrase into my vernacular as something to joke about when people are like, you sure are extra. I'm like, well, I was a strong-willed child, like as a joke. I had never connected any of these dots. I did not know that was a James Dobson book. I didn't even realize it was on my shelf and I had been sleeping next to it for years.
Oh my gosh.
And I just looked at it one day and I was like, oh my God, it says James Dobson. And I had this moment of like, it just was so many unconnected connections were like, oh, there's the connection. I found it. And I had been looking.
Yep.
And it had been looking at me and staring me in the face for years. And I had never made that connection. So yes, it still happens. That was just a couple months ago that happened.
Wow.
And even little things that from my childhood, I'm just like, and it's that sort of thing that when you said, you know, like you still have these moments of like, oh my God, that's what this means. Or, oh my God, that's what they said. It's just, it's this phenomenon of processing and healing from something that's like so deep and so complex and that you have to really unpack and like read page by page. Like it comes in waves and sometimes it surprises you. And so, yeah, like I, not the same experience, but it's a similar thing. So I understand what you mean.
For sure. I mean, it doesn't even matter what kind of cult you were in or what kind of coercion and control system you were in. Like when you unpack, it tends to come in chunks. I don't know anyone that has ever just like woken up and everything comes out at once. And I think it's because I think it's like a good chunk can, right? Enough to like wake you up enough to be like, oh God, I want to get out. But the rest of it comes in chunks, I feel like, because your body can't handle it. Like you have to take it one step at a time. And I think your body instinctively knows that it'll be too overwhelming to have it like have everything happen at once. And so that's why I believe it happens, because it's always like when I feel like I'm doing so good and I'm like, oh my God, I'm so processed. And it's like, boom. You ready for another one?
Yeah. Your brain's like, really hold my beer. Boom.
Exactly.
Here's something that you can work on for the next couple months.
Right.
Don't sass me again.
Cancel meetings.
Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously you're in this position that it was not of your volition. You stayed until you were 18 years old. Is that how you ended up getting out? Was you just aged out?
So much worse. So much worse.
Oh, okay. All right.
I stayed until I was 18 and a half.
Oh.
So I was born in August. And so I actually had the chance of going home. Well, I say chance because I was going to be 18, but I turned 18 before my senior year. So I'm the oldest in my class, right? So I was 18 all of senior year. And, you know, I brought up the discussion of me going home for my senior year. And while my parents didn't say no, they kind of displayed their wishes, I guess, that they'd prefer blah, blah. Obviously, everyone knew I was going to be 18 and that's my choice, right? I could push it and say that I wanted to leave. But because of my newfound and newly set people pleasing that had developed as a result of being in Chrysalis, it was more important to make my parents happy than to do what I needed to do. And that's something that's taken the next, you know, the next 20 years, I've had to learn like, okay, no, it's not about everyone else. It's about doing what I need. And, you know, breaking free from that was big. Basically them not feeling totally on board with it made me say, okay, fine. Then I guess we're not going to do it, you know? And I just gave that up. So I didn't leave until May. So I had been 18 since August. So yeah, like 18 and a half. And I went home after graduating both Chrysalis and graduating high school. And I went home for the summer and went straight to college. So I went from a very controlled environment into completely free environment. So it was definitely different. But one thing I'm going to add that is going to be interesting for the people who are survivors listening to this is that I had a very unique high school experience within my therapeutic boarding school. And that is, I've never actually heard of another program. So if you went to a program that's similar to this, I would love to hear which program it is. Because when you are on level 2 at Chrysalis, you are given the option, at least back then, not anymore, I don't think, but given the option of going to the public high school. So I lived at the therapeutic boarding school, but every morning I would take the bus. If you missed it, you rode your bike 14 miles in the snow, but I took the bus every morning to go to this public high school. And I had a normal schedule at the high school. And there was a bunch of Chrysalis girls at the high school that are on level 2. So you're able to have a normal high school experience. However, there are people that are on Kenny's approved list. And if they have ever smoked pot, if they've ever gone to keggers, if they've ever drank, they are on the non-approved list. And because you're with a lot of other Chrysalis girls and everyone in town knows you're a Chrysalis girl, if you fuck up, they're calling Kenny. So you are still 100% under his control. And you're also being watched by your peers. I remember there was one time I spoke to this guy that was unapproved and I had like a crush on him, right? I just spoke to him. That's it. Just spoke to him. I was confronted in circle because I was flirting, apparently, and I was speaking to someone that wasn't approved. And I almost got pulled from school. Even though you were free, in quotes, you were not free. You were 100% still bounded within Chrysalis. But I have to say that it likely saved my life. Being able to get out of the actual Chrysalis facility and go to normal public school was like a godsend to me. Even though I was still being watched, even though I was still held accountable for everything, it was just a reprieve, honestly, to be able to like have friends that weren't Chrysalis girls. As much as I love them, nothing against them, but you're around the same people all the time. It was good to get some kind of like variety in people. It probably saved my life, to be honest. And it's something you don't hear a ton about other programs doing. And especially now, and that's probably why, because they want to lock down the girls more.
Are other programs, when they do like education, is it just like homeschool based stuff and they're not on campus or they have their own curriculum?
It depends on the program, but you know, a lot of programs aren't taught by teachers. You'll just have like packets you read. I had to be homeschooled at Chrysalis to catch up from what I had lost at the hospital. And I did like a year and a half in about a year. And that was all just like giving me packets. And I'd say, hey, I'm ready for the test. And I didn't have any teachers or anything like that. There's that option. But then sometimes they'll hire teachers. They'll have actual teachers. And everyone's at a different place though. So it's kind of self-study. Some are accredited, some aren't. It's really across the board. It's pretty varied, but nonetheless, no matter what kind of education they claim to have, I feel as though most people I talk about report that they're not prepared for either going back to high school where they are or going to college when they leave.
So when you finally aged out, you stay to graduate, you leave, you come home for the summer, prepare to go to college. What was that transition like coming back home for those couple months before leaving again? And how were you feeling about the last 3+ years of being at Chrysalis and at the facilities?
I remember it was very much so like a culture shock. Like I remember for the graduation present. That's right. For graduation, my parents got me a cell phone. And I remember it was a Samsung and it had like the flip. You could like flip it around 360 to face the inside on the outside, you know? And that was my graduation present. And I remember opening it and being like, what? Because I like didn't know, because I was in the program from 2001 to 2004. Like that's when cell phones got big. And like, I didn't have a cell phone before leaving the program. So my first cell phone was at 18, whereas I was 100% the generation that got cell phones when they were like 13, 14, 15, right? It was that generation. So I didn't know that was something everyone had. And so I literally had to like learn it. And I didn't know that most people had cell phones at this point. It was wow. So crazy because like landlines were definitely still very much so a thing. And that's how we spoke to our parents. And so I didn't really see cell phones at all. And so I was like, what is going on? Right. And then also I remember feeling just like I knew better than to not feel grateful for my experience. So that was really embedded in me. And it was very much so like a thank God for Chrysalis. That was echoed by my parents as well, just because that had been ingrained in them. And I instinctively didn't talk about it a ton when I went to college. And people would say, you know, it's so funny because I have a book coming out. And in my memoir, I talk about this. Like people always ask, where'd you go to high school when you go to college? And you're like, hey, where are you from? What high school did you go to? And I'm like, I went to a boarding school. Like you don't say therapeutic boarding, you just say boarding school. And then all the questions come in. Like, and one of the most common questions when I say I went to a boarding school is, man, what'd you do to get sent to one of those? That's literally the most common thing. And so like, I just learned that if I didn't want to answer questions because it's complicated, I just said like, oh, I just went to a boarding school. Yep. And what did you do to get sent away? Well, you know, I smoked pot. Yeah. I just did something like that. And it's funny though, because I didn't really start to think anything of it. And when I say think anything of it, it wasn't thinking much more than like, eh, yeah, I guess it's kind of fucked up. But I had a boyfriend in college that asked more questions about why I went to boarding school. And I told him about the being kidnapped part. And he was so mad at my parents. And he was so flabbergasted as to how the fuck can you do that? And I remember being mad at him, like, how dare you judge like my parents for that? And it saved my life. You know, like I didn't let myself like get to that point of like, whoa, like you're right. But I remember thinking like, that's a little off. I guess that is kind of weird. But I was very protective still of opening up that can of worms. I definitely, as far as socially, went from thinking that when you're friends with people, you confront them into an environment where like, that's definitely not the case. So I remember like anytime I was mad at like my friends, I'd be like, I'm really upset with you. And my hope for you is that you can continue to learn and grow so that you don't piss me off. And like, I would just like confront my friends in, in like a very direct way. And I learned very quickly that like, that didn't work. And so I had to like, I had to relearn social norms. I mean, I'm not going to lie. Like it was like being thrown into the wild. And of course I started drinking and normal amounts. Like I wasn't like crazy, but I started having fun and experiencing life. That stopped quickly when I got an email from Mary.
Oh no.
Yeah. She heard from people at Carroll College that I was partying and she wanted to give me a chance to explain myself. I remember even then, I think I was 19 years old and she's reaching out to me, not my therapist anymore, like so illegal to be doing that and saying that she wants to give me a chance to hold myself accountable.
Wow.
And what I do? Of course, I fawned all over that shit.
Oh yeah, because you were still into it.
I was so embarrassed that I did something wrong. Like, I'm so sorry, Mary. I know I made a big mistake because here's the thing. Mary was a substance abuse counselor. So if you had smoked weed ever, you were forced to go into NA. If you drank ever, you're an AA. So they convinced me I was an alcoholic and an addict. So I went to NA and AA for 3.5 years. So I went into college thinking, oh yeah, I haven't smoked pot in 3.5 years, like, because I'm an addict, but I wasn't a fucking addict. And so I instinctively knew that she was full of shit. And like, if I read my journals, I'm saying like, Mary, I'm kind of confused because everything I'm learning about alcoholism is that if I was an alcoholic or an addict, like, wouldn't I be craving it?
Yeah.
Wouldn't I have a problem with like, you know, with wanting it and not being able to have it? And she just always like explained it away. And I have proof in my journals that this was happening. Like I'm questioning it. It's just so funny because I went back to the scripts. Oh, I know that it's been bad and I'm going to stop and I'm so sorry. I hope you forgive me. I love you. Like it was so fucking bizarre. Like I have that email still. It's so bizarre.
They got you good, girl.
I know.
They got you good. Even the way you're interacting with your friends, you're like, what I'm hearing you say is.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
They're like, why are you talking like this?
Yeah, I know. It's so cringe. I swear. And what's crazy is that like, here I was a graduate of Chrysalis, right? And graduates get a pretty little Chrysalis ring, like made out of like white gold and sterling silver and all that stuff, right? So I'm a proud Chrysalis graduate because I drank. Like if you drink in college, you're now on the unapproved list. You can't come back. You know, like you are excommunicated. And what's crazy is that Kenny always made a really big deal about how he used to say this, Chrysalis girls are expected to be in their beds at night. There aren't any bolts and chains on these walls. He used to say that all the time. And if you ran away from Chrysalis, you are done. Like you are losing everything that you've ever cared about. So like if a girl that was like, I've seen this happen, one of Kenny's favorites, right? Ran away and she was a loved member of Chrysalis. Like we all loved her. We were not allowed to speak about her. She got kicked out of Chrysalis and our Chrysalis sister was gone as far as we knew it. We could not speak about any of them. We couldn't talk about how we're sad. We couldn't talk about like anything. We had to view them as someone that is not a part of the Chrysalis program anymore and they're not healthy and they're toxic and you know they aren't a good influence and they just, it's so similar to the cult, right? To cult life. And it's sad, very sad. It really taught me that if someone doesn't have the same opinion as you, they're wrong and you can't connect with them. You can't be friends with them. And it really instilled that in me. And it even happened once you left, even if it's a loved member of Chrysalis. Like if you didn't have the same opinions as you grew and became an adult, can't.
It's really just like the excommunication. It's just, it's wow.
Yeah, I know.
How sad.
I know.
So you're in college, you're growing up, you're moving on with your life, you're graduating, getting a job. You're living a life. And you said at the beginning of this that it was only a few years ago that you actually stopped and sort of paused and started to unpack this and sort of realize that. So
right.
Take us to that moment where you realized, oh my God, that school I went to that I thought saved my life and was the best thing ever might have actually been like a really horrifically abusive cult.
Yeah. So that was kind of interesting because one thing that was really instilled in me at Chrysalis was production. You must produce. And what you produce is how you're perceived. And if you do good, if you're successful, then you will be liked. And so that was my goal, I think, coming out is I must get all A's. I have to overachieve. I have to have my parents be proud of me. Everyone around me has to be proud of me. I'm going to overwork and do all this stuff, right? I instinctively, it's interesting, went into psychology and I ended up graduating with honors in psychology because I wanted to understand humans because obviously I was autistic and I was struggling socially. And so I began to like study humans, study behavior, study mannerisms, things that I just didn't instinctively understand. And what that did is it created this, you know, I like to think of it as like a file cabinet, right? That along with my love of watching movies and TV shows, I used as understanding to how to respond in certain circumstances and what your face should look like when someone tells you someone dies, right? When you should laugh and when you should not laugh, you know, those kinds of things I had to learn, right? And so what Chrysalis effectively did is it taught me how to have a very sturdy mask and how to appear neurotypical because everything that I was abused for in Chrysalis was, in my opinion, because I was neurodivergent. And so I was taught to act very neurotypical. They didn't know I was autistic, obviously, but that is what I view it as. The things that I had to work on were like social cues and abrasiveness and being too direct and being in people's business and like things like that. Basically, psychology was my way of like strengthening that mask. And so I graduated and I went right into the workforce, started in nonprofits, eventually went and started a franchise for dog behavioral therapist and training. I did that. And then I started my own photography business. I was a professional photographer for 7 years. Throughout all of that, I also was doing a lot of nonprofit work. I became the vice president and managing director of the Gochnauer Foundation and had been involved with basically doing site visits and being a board member on that. Then it slowly grew into me managing everything with the foundation and also doing those little endeavors I told you about, like the franchise owner and the photography business. And then it kind of slowly went into doing a lot more of the nonprofit work where I've been on nationally probably like 9 or 10 different board of directors, helping them with fundraising and program expansion and things like that. And so I really started to really love the nonprofit work. And so it slowly over my professional career started to go toward that. And it's interesting when you look at the trauma, you never saw it in the professional career. And that is what I learned as to how to have a mask, right? But if you're wearing a mask all day long, you're coming home and you're taking off that mask if you can. My personal life was just falling apart. It's very separate. You never saw any of it, but I had 2 different divorces, very abusive relationships. It was falling apart personally. And then my professional career was doing very well. And if you ask the people in my professional career throughout the entire career, they wouldn't have known anything was going on behind the scenes. And upholding that mask of, I'm okay, I swear I'm okay, is exhausting. It's exhausting. I think that's what eventually led to the waking up. I also think that having kids was a very big part of that as well. Like I said, you know, looking at my kid and being like, would I want that to happen to them? And it started to slowly just feel really fucked up. Like the whole situation started to feel really fucked up. But, you know, like many other people, I didn't really have that wake up moment until I saw Paris Hilton's documentary. And that is when I realized, oh, fuck. Not only did her transport service say the exact same words to her, we're going to do this the easy way or the hard way, as they said to me. But I also realized it was a fucking industry. This isn't just Chrysalis out there. This is Chrysalis cloned times 5,000. And it just dawned on me. And I was like, oh my God, that's so fucked up. that is when I had my first portion of waking up. You know, there was also the component earlier than that, one of my chrysalis sisters passed away. And that started the conversation of knowing how much she struggled with trauma. That was the first portion of realizing, oh, maybe not everything that happened there was okay. And I remember texting my really good friend from the program and saying, hey, remember this would happen in chrysalis? Was that fucked up? And she'd be like, yeah, no, that was abuse. And I was like, wait, what? I'm like, why didn't you tell me? And she's like, you weren't ready. And she had known since she was there that it's abuse, but I wasn't ready at that point, right? And so I had known that some things were kind of fucked up, but I hadn't woken up like, oh shit, this happened to me and millions of others. Like that is what really woke me up with Paris's doc. This is like a really good story. And I go over the entire thing in my memoir that it basically, I got to a level of like, oh my God, this is an industry. Oh my God, I was abused. So Paris's doc basically got me to that point of like, oh my God, I was abused. This is so fucked up. I can't believe this exists. Then I started like researching like boarding school syndrome, like very basic stuff that exists. And it's more of a UK thing, like boarding school syndrome, all this stuff. But then I realized therapeutic boarding schools exist. And I'm like, what? Wait, that was mine. And kind of realizing, I kind of heard about WASP and those kind of programs. That's just the tip of the iceberg of what I started to uncover. Then my husband, who was a recovering addict, basically had a relapse and had to go to treatment. And he went to a rehab and it was going great. But then all of a sudden, I get a call from an unknown number. It's like blocked. And I pick it up and it's him and he's crying. And he said, I think I'm being abused. All of a sudden, something in me shifted. I was sitting there going, oh my God, here's my husband saying he's being abused. He's crying. That doesn't happen. Like he doesn't say I'm being, like I've never heard those words being said out of his mouth. And all of a sudden I turned into the person I needed when I was a kid. And it's almost like I was on this mission. I'm going to go save him from this institutional abuse. And I remember I had my baby at the time was like 9 months old and he was sleeping and I grabbed him and I put him in the car seat and I had the nanny meet me on the highway side of the highway. And I like transferred Bentley over into her car and I just zoomed to this facility. And by the time I got there, they had kicked him out. He had his stuff on the curb and they were instructed to not let me near the facility and all of this. It was, he had been completely gaslit. They wouldn't give him his records because he wanted to transfer to outpatient. Just because he wanted to transfer to outpatient, they wanted to keep him there. On that drive, I realized, oh my God, I'm doing what I needed someone to do for me. And that is when I gained my purpose. That is when I knew I am going to start an organization that is going to take down this industry. And I won't stop until I do. And ironically, the things that Chrysalis instilled in me is what makes that possible. The tenacity, the not stopping until I get what I fucking want. And it's so funny. So it's just like, thanks, Mary and Kenny, because thanks to you and like abusing me, I now will not stop until the entire industry is just done. It's kind of ironic, but that is when I realized I started having a lot of CPTSD symptoms, a lot, when I woke up. And so I decided I'm not going to do anything until I can heal a little bit. And so I ended up going into EMDR and other types of therapy, but I was doing EMDR 3 hours a week, no, 3 or 6 hours a week. And I did that for about 6 months. And then I remember thinking, I'm ready. And that is when I got into the activism and started Unsilenced. That's where it all began.
Wow. I love a good origin story like that.
Yeah.
And it's really funny that these institutional abusive places like the troubled teen industry, like Scientology, like multi-level marketing is so surprised when those of us they've abused are the kind of people that are like, hell hath no fury. I'm going to take you down. Like I'm going to show everybody else.
Yeah.
Maybe they just didn't think that anybody would ever stand up to them. And there's so many of us that are doing this. Your activism is incredible. Let's talk about Unsilenced. And what you guys are doing right now for the troubled teen industry.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. God, Unsilenced has just been, it's so wild to look back at the last like a little over 2 years and just see what we've done. Cause it feels like it's been five. I'm not going to lie. Like how fast things started to move and how quickly, you know, we were starting to be in the media, getting more attention, panels and conferences and keynotes and all of that. I mean, it's pretty crazy. Right now where we find ourselves, you know, we've been through a little bit of an evolution, if you will. Now we're finding our niche of really being good at finding plaintiffs to be able to connect to law firms, to be able to let them know their rights, be able to help them understand what statutes of limitations are, and help them understand that what they went through is very much so abuse. Also, on the same side of helping enable them and empower them to use their voice and to tell their stories, help find justice in any way. Our new justice support component of Unsilenced is so important. And it's not just lawsuits. Like, you know, there's people that are outside of the statutes of limitations. How do they find justice? How are they going to feel vindicated and validated in their experiences? And, you know, hey, why don't you reach out to this podcast, tell your story, or write a book, or, you know, like giving them options of how they can have their justice, because it's going to look different for everyone. But then, you know, you have the kids that are literally kids reaching out to us saying, I was abused, or I was sexually assaulted, or all of these things. And, you know, we've made it our mission to create a network of attorneys throughout the entire country that we are utilizing to facilitate justice for those people. Like if someone reaches out in Oklahoma, and they're like, I went to a program in, let's say, Montana, and this happened to me, this happened to me, this happened to me, I'll go, oh my gosh, well, I'm going to tell you that I think that you have a shot at being able to be in the statutes of limitations. I'd love to be able to connect you with a lawyer. And then I give them options for people that we have talked to and vetted in that in Montana, and they get to choose. And, you know, it's very empowering to know that we're putting justice back into survivors' hands. And, you know, if you look at the last couple of weeks with Trails Carolina, and I've been very heavily involved in that. We're helping with numerous lawsuits for alleging sexual assault for Trails Carolina. And then this, you know, obviously the death of the 12-year-old that happened most recently and being involved with that and the investigations. It's crazy how if you give awareness to these lawsuits, if you give awareness to the injustices that are existing within these facilities, how quickly, you know, survivors come forward. That is proving to be very amazing. I mean, we've had a hand in probably at this point, maybe 20 lawsuits in the last year, and being able to help find plaintiffs and witnesses through experience surveys and utilizing our network of survivors and putting out on social media, like, hey, do you know this staff? Or did you experience these types of things? And we're getting such a crazy response of everyone experiencing it. And, you know, just connecting those dots that it's hard to do unless there's someone that is the point person of trying to like demystify everything. And Silence has really proven itself to be good at that. And then on the flip side, you know, we're also very involved with the preventative part of this, right? You know, how do we stop institutionalization? Because there's that social change that needs to happen, and educating, or I like to say re-educating the public and parents and decision makers and communities as to the reasons why kids should stay within their community. That's done through Project SPEAK, which stands for Survivor Prevention Through Education, Awareness, and Knowledge. And we teach people about the troubled teen industry and the dangers that are inherent within it and how survivors will suffer as a result of it. And so last year, we, let's see if I add everything up, maybe 5,000 people heard Project SPEAK presentations throughout the country. And just being able to have that change, it's very cool. Very cool.
Wow. Yeah. That is incredible.
Yeah. And then we also have obviously survivors who are already survivors and there's nothing you can do about it. So we trying to figure out how would we support them. And we do that in two ways. We offer free community support groups led by mental health professionals, no cost. And it's not therapy. It's just kind of a community support group. And you're able to talk to other survivors and hear other experiences, be validated and get coping mechanism options and things like that. We have two different ones that run. One is neurodivergent focused, and then one is just a general support group. Then the other thing is providing independence packs, which are packs with a laptop preloaded with resources, you know, resume templates, things like that. Resources, how to get a driver's license, how to get your records, how to get a free cell phone from the state, those kinds of things. You know, there's gift cards in the backpack, lots of, you know, essential items, those kinds of things. We send them to survivors who have aged out of programs. So they're, you know, they're 18 and they're unfortunately facing homelessness. We send them to survivors across the country. So those are the ways that we kind of support.
So for anybody listening right now who may be a survivor of the troubled teen industry and who has been looking for resources, what is the best way for them to find you and get in touch?
Well, I think the best way is to go to unsilenced.org. That has all the information that you can possibly imagine, whether that is information on your program. You can find it on the program archive that it exists there. And you can kind of look up your program name and see all the documents and DHS reports and everything that you could possibly want to see on your program. And then that also has, there's links on the website to our support groups and how to sign up for those, along with an application for the Independence PACs and how you can get access to one of those if you are eligible to receive one and battling homelessness. And then if you're wanting to follow me and follow Unsilenced, you can follow me on TikTok and Instagram at the handle at Meg Applegate. That's MEGAPPELGATE. And then for Unsilenced, it's at unsilenced_now.
And I will add everything to the show notes to make it easier for you guys to just click and follow. Well, okay, I have some questions for you before we end this, but I also just want to say thank you so much for being so open and candid and just telling us your story.
Yeah, of course. I'm happy to do it.
Thank you. Okay, so at the end, I do these rapid fire questions. I have adjusted them for the troubled teen industry, but there is one MLM question, so you're going to have to think about that for a second. But okay, so Meg, what is one word that encompasses how you feel about the troubled teen industry?
Deceptive.
Give me a piece of advice to parents listening right now who maybe before listening to this episode thought that the troubled teen industry might actually be a good option for their kids. What would you tell them?
I would tell them, don't make a decision without consulting your kid, and be sure to separate what you view as things they need to work on versus what is very normal for kids that age. And that no answer is going to be separating the family unit and one party working on things. If you want a better relationship with your child, if you want them to be better acting as their true self, if you will, then working on your relationship with your kid, getting help for yourself separately, are all going to be things that need to happen. There is no one size fits all approach that sending your child away to a facility is going to be able to fix anything. In fact, the most important thing I can say is that if you decide to send your child away, you need to be prepared for your relationship to suffer for the rest of their lives. And I need you to prepare for that, because I would say probably, you know, upwards of 90% of the survivors I know have cut off contact with their family for making that decision. And the other parts who still have contact with their family have learned that they just don't talk about it because it's not validated. Your relationship is going to have effects, and you need to go into that decision knowing what you're giving up. So it's about figuring out what is important to you, them going to school and acting how you want them, or having a relationship for the rest of your life.
Very powerful advice. What is the worst MLM in your opinion?
I'd consider NXIVM to be a MLM for sure. And I would say NXIVM, probably one of the most fucked up MLMs that I've kind of learned about. Now, there might be others that I just don't know a ton about. But, you know, I'm friends with Sarah Edmondson, and like things that I've heard are just like,
yeah,
Jesus. Like there's just, I think also what makes it the worst is like what I know about Keith Raniere is so fucked up, like just the person that he is. And like, you know, I've watched the documentaries, like I've seen how he is. And it's, in my opinion, like he's so sociopathic that it just, It's just like, whoa, my God. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And that element of like completely void of any good, he creeps me the fuck out. So like, I would say That one. And also just like how easily it went from like, you know, normal cult to like, oh yeah, we're going to add in the like sex slaves and we're going like, it's just, it was like a seamless, like it takes a freaking sociopath in my opinion to just seamlessly do that, you know?
Right.
So I think that's probably the most fucked up one.
When you were describing the levels and how you like could go up the levels, but it was like, there was really no like checklist. It's just sort of like the discernment of the leaders, like when you get to level up.
For sure.
It absolutely 100% reminded me of like Sarah telling me about the sashes. Just like, sometimes you get them early, sometimes it takes years. And it just,
I know.
I like immediately was like, these are NXIVM sash levels. Like this.
For sure. Well, and it's funny too, because like you never know when you get your levels. And for some girls, I remember being so pissed because like, obviously I had to work a lot to get my levels. But I remember girls being there for like 3 months and getting their level two. I'm like, what the fuck? Like, that's not right? fair. What the fuck is going on? Right. And it took me 9 fucking months. Are you kidding me? You know, and there was just no rhyme or reason. It's basically if they like you.
Right. And it's just to fuck with you even more. They're like, oh, this new girl, you want to see how we're going to fuck with Meg? You're promoted. You're not.
Hold my beer. Watch this.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So what is the hardest lesson that you learned while in the troubled teen industry?
Being taught that who I am is not good enough. I'd say they pushed that really heavily. That I remember them telling me, Kenny told me, he said, if you don't change your personality, you're not going to be accepted into society and you're not going to have any friends. And it just stuck in my head, and really just the way that they broke me down, because they made me believe that the way that I am now is not good enough. And that's been really hard to like untangle throughout my life and figure out that that's not true. So I'd say that's probably like the hardest thing I had to hear and then learn isn't true throughout my life.
And then we like to end it on a positive. So give me a positive takeaway from your experience with the troubled teen industry.
I guess my experiences led to Unsilenced and led to me eventually, because of the abuse, going down the road of trying to make other people's lives better and, you know, fix this societal issue and this health issue that's going on. And I think that here I am, and would I have found purpose otherwise? Probably, but I enjoy this one. So all I can really do is just be thankful. Is a really not okay word to say, but kind of makes me, that's a difficult one to talk about because it's talking about, you know, trauma. So yeah, I would say just, you know, if it wasn't for Chrysalis, I probably wouldn't be running Unsilenced. And I think that Unsilenced is going to do incredible things for society and for kids. So I'm happy that is what I'm doing, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful answer. And here's the thing, a chrysalis is a cocoon, right? So here you are going through this transformation, which is literally what happens in a chrysalis, which is like, I know like that's why they call it that. But like, let's take the positive of that. You go in, you're in this chrysalis, you become this goo and you rebuild yourself. And now you are this gorgeous butterfly running this incredible foundation to help children. Not have to go through the shit you went through. I think that is an incredible transformation. I think that is a beautiful positive takeaway from the bullshit that you had to go through. And I am so unbelievably proud of you and so happy to be able to call you a friend and a colleague.
Thank you.
To be able to talk to you in this space and open up this conversation. I know there are people listening right now who are like, oh, yeah, okay. If you are in the troubled teen industry and you need help, you need resources, please reach out to Meg, to Unsilenced. If you want to tell your story, I am happy to provide the platform for you to do that if you are ready to do that. We want to keep this conversation about these culty, high demand groups and organizations in the forefront of our minds and our thoughts and keep talking about this so it's in the media, keep making noise. They abused people and we aren't going to let them forget about it. So I just, again, I want to say thank you so much for coming and sharing your story.
Yeah.
And starting this conversation, because I know this is a conversation that a lot of people have been waiting for me to have. And it's something that I would love to continue talking about.
Absolutely. I'm so happy to be here. And I appreciate the opportunity to be able to tell my story and also just try to reach more people that to tell them that they're not alone. You know, I think that it's important that there are survivors out there that know that this is an industry and that there's a community of survivors that are ready to welcome you with open arms if you're ready.
Wow. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to Life After MLM. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. And follow us on social media at Life After MLM Podcast or visit our website at lifeaftermlmpod.com. And don't forget to check out our Patreon for exclusive content and join the community on Discord. You can find all of the links to follow in our show notes. Life After MLM is produced by Roberta Blevins. Audio editing is done by the lovely Kayla Craven. Video editing by the indescribable RK Gold. And Michelle Carpenter is our triple emerald princess of robots. If you have a story about a cult, fraud, scam, or MLM and want to be on the show, please hit us up. We would love to help you tell your story and start your healing journey in life after MLM. See you next time, Huns.